Go Loud. Talking Bollocks, a Go Loud original podcast. Sponsored by Right Style Furniture. Right price, right style, right now. Visit rightstyle.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Are you still sitting on a beanbag in your sitting room like you're 17?
Grow up and head to Right Style Furniture. They've got proper, comfy, stylish gear and they're Irish and family run too.
The house packages are class. For just €3,649, you get an electric sofa set, full dining setup, and beds with mattresses. That's a serious bang for your buck.
I got my corner sofa off them, and I haven't stood up since.
They've got locations in Font Hill, Belgard, and now Omni Park, open every day and late on a Thursday and Friday in Font Hill and Omni.
One-stop shop for kitting out the gaff. Don't say we never looked after you.
Exactly. Right price, right style, right now.
Visit www.rightstyle.ie. And when you shop in store, tell them Terrence and Calvin sent you, and they'll throw a discount on top of that as well. So get down to Right Style Furniture today.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in it now. Fill your body up. Walk it hard and low. When you finish that.
The hip knocker.
Go down. Go down. Go down.
Episode 267 of the Talking Bollocks podcast, brought to you by Go Loud. It's me, Terry Flower.
Me, COB.
And this week we're joined by
John Sweetman from Lines of Inquiry.
Tagline and all.
I have to get the tagline in.
Very official, John, yeah. Come here. I'll just ask you a question then. I said, just wait till we turn the mics off. Or on, I should say. You're doing a podcast now over here, Lines of Inquiry.
Yeah.
And it's booming.
Yeah, it's just, it took off like I don't know what. Like, I can't believe it.
What made you even want to do a podcast?
Well, to be honest, nothing really. Like, you know, it came out of the blue. Darren, the producer, contacted me out of the blue there towards the end of last year.
I know a few people have the same story.
Yeah. But I thought it was just in relation to maybe a bit of background or a bit of advice or maybe even an interview. But no, they were looking for a host. So I came in, did a read, went through the first script and just kept going, like, you know, so...
It's flying.
I still can't believe it. Like, you know.
I was only saying, I walked into the house the other night and the missus had on. She loves it. And I was like, is that the Lines of Inquiry? She was like, yeah, I think she was on like 3 episodes that day.
Yeah, it seems to have hit a chord with a lot of people. And my own young fella came home from work there the other day and he said there's a lady in work. Now, when he says lady, she's obviously my age or older, but she's mad for this podcast. And she was asking me today, is your father still with your mother, by the way? Like, you know, they're just mad for it. Like, mad for the podcast.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we're doing something right. It's a good team. Like,
yeah, of course. No, it's booming at the minute. John, give us a bit of a background on yourself.
Yeah, well, I retired from the Guards there nearly 3 years ago. Retired in 2023. Spent most of my time, I spent 25 years in the Technical Bureau. So that's, you know, your kind of forensic end of stuff between, I was working as a fingerprint expert and then later on as documents and handwriting expert. So I wasn't out on the beat that much. Like, I did a couple of years at the very start and I didn't like it at all. I just wasn't suited to it, you know, but I was lucky enough that I got into the fingerprint section when I did. Never looked back. Like, you know, it was good to specialize in something like that because you know, when I was going to school and stuff, I was always mad into art and detail and all that kind of crack. So the type of work that I ended up doing in the Technical Bureau played to my strengths in that regard, you know. And then podcast comes along, you know, which is great because I'm able to go back into stuff that maybe I was involved with or was familiar with, but then I'm getting exposed to so much more and I'm getting to meet people, you know, meet other investigators and people like that. And yeah, it's just been a fantastic opportunity. Like,
where are you from?
I'm from North County Dublin, from Skerries, born and bred. My dad was a farmer, so, you know, there's no other guards in the family. I don't know really how I fell into it, to be honest. Like, you know, it was kind of a backup plan at the time. You know, I left school, got a job in an animation company doing the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
As in the cartoon or the comic?
The cartoon.
One in the...
Yeah, early 90s.
90s, yeah.
Yeah. So we had the contract for that place called Murakami Wolf, and that was great. You know, I was only 18, I was earning good money.
And it's absolutely iconic now as well. So is your name on the credits for that?
No.
That's a shame.
No, I was a cell painter, and the cell painters didn't get their names because there were so many of us. And I was just about to go for an animation assistant's job when they lost the contract for the Turtles and they let a load of us go.
Yeah.
And I was one of them. Now, I could have gone into any other animation company at the time, but I was a bit fed up coming in and out of town on trains every day and whatnot. So I just stayed at home on the farm for a couple of years. And in the background, somewhere along the way, I had applied for the Guards, not really giving it much thought, apart from the fact that, you know, there's a pension there, you know. And I just kept getting through each part of the application process. And eventually, you know, before I knew it, I found myself down at Templemore. And, you know, I'd swore I'd never wear a uniform again after I finished me leave, and I came home and I said, never again, never putting on a fucking uniform again. And here I was in a bloody uniform and that. So it was a bit of a, you know, an awakening for me. I kind of realised fairly quickly that, Jesus, this mightn't be for me. But it was a different, you know, it was a different time back then. Like, anybody going for the Guards, 9 times out of 10, that was going to be their career now for the next 30 or more years. Like, you didn't get people coming in, trying it out and then dropping out. It just didn't happen. Like, you know, we were all in our early 20s or whatever, fairly green around the gills and stuff, but there wasn't much else around. Like, you know, there wasn't that much of a kind of, you know, secure jobs with a pension at the time. So I just stuck it out until I found a spot that suited me, and that was it. That was great. Like, you know.
What was the area like that you grew up in? Would that have been frowned upon to
no,
point
no.
to the Guards, or would that have been looked up to?
Look? Oh, no, like, you know, like, Skerry's a quiet enough town. There's not much trouble or anything in it, like, you know. And even nowadays, like, there's a Garda station there, but it's rarely open. Like, they'd be out and about. They'd be based out of Balbriggan most of the time. But, you know, it was looked at as, you know, a good thing if your son or your daughter had applied for the Guards. It was looked upon as, yeah, Jesus.
Respected, like.
Yeah.
You said you didn't like being on the B.
No.
What did you not like about it?
I didn't know. I didn't have any confidence. You know, I didn't have any self-confidence. Like, you know, I wouldn't be able to, you know, if you got into some kind of situation where you needed to talk your way through it rather than lose the head and stuff like that. I was very quiet, you know, and just, I was kind of like shy and stuff like that. And, you know, it takes a fair bit of confidence and being assured of yourself. And I just didn't have it. And it didn't help that, like, my first station, it was brilliant for me from the point of view of travel, was Malahide. And at the time, that was only 15 minutes up the road from me. And it's not near, it wasn't nearly as big or as expanded as it is now. And it was great and I liked it, but it was really, really quiet. So for the 9 months I was there, I didn't get a huge amount of experience. You know, you could have very, like, have a week a night, say, where you're working nights, and maybe nothing fucking happening all week until a Saturday or a Sunday night. So it was very quiet. Whereas a lot of the other people that were in my class and that maybe got stations like Store Street or the Bridewell or busy stations down in Cork and Limerick and stuff like that, and they were getting the experience. And then on top of that, when I finally passed out at Templemore with, you know, sworn in as a guard and all this crack, I got sent into the command and control place where you'd be dispatching cars and answering 999 calls. So I was there for a couple of years, and again, it was good. There was plenty of overtime. You had no paperwork, you had no files, you know, you rarely had to go to court, but you still weren't getting any experience, you know, whereas all the other people that I would have passed out with Templemore with, they were out there doing the job, getting the experience, getting confident. So when I finally got out of there, I had about 4 years service at that stage. And I still hadn't feck all experience, you know. I'd damn all arrests and all this sort of stuff because of just the circumstances I'd found myself in. So I didn't like it, and I wasn't going to stay in it. And I was trying to build up the courage to quit when I discovered the fingerprint section through, you know, some poor devil out in Hout there where I was stationed. He got glassed in the pub one night, you know. So the guard that was with me brought the pint glass into the fingerprint section to get examined, and I went with him. And I saw this place, like, air-conditioned, you know, computers, everybody in plain clothes, all this sort of stuff, looking at detailed bits and bobs. And I said, Jesus, this is for me, you know. And at the time, it wasn't really well known that these positions existed. Like, I certainly didn't occur to me. And then vacancies come up within a year. I kept my foot in the door and I got in there and never looked back, you know. Mm. It was the best thing ever happened to me, like, in the Guards.
What was your force case then? Do you remember your first case?
In the technical bureau, yeah. Yeah, well, we would have been sent out as we were training, doing crime scenes, say, for burglaries and stuff like that. We'd be out around the South City and city centre, going to houses and premises that had been broken into and, you know, powdering for fingerprints and bringing back exhibits. So we did a lot of that. But then I remember the first ever suspicious debt that I went to was down in, it was in Roscommon, I think it was 1998. And you get a lot of suspicious deaths, you know, and most of them turn out to be not suspicious, you know, either through accident, natural causes, or maybe somebody, you know, taking their own life or something. But this was a man that had shot himself in a house out in the middle of nowhere. Like you wouldn't be able to find it on a map. But he was there a few days, and heating was on and stuff like that. So it was a bit of a wake up for me, because I had been to the morgue to print bodies before, and that was fine. But that's in a kind of sterile environment and air conditioning and whatnot. But this was, you know, the real thing at somebody's house, and they're there in the position they were when whatever happened. It's a lot to take in, you know, because it's a shock to the senses, not only obviously from the guts and the gore end of it, but it's a lot to take in. But very quickly, like, I copped on that you're there to do the job, you know. And on that case, I was, you know, I was really just there as to assist the fingerprint expert that was there. But, you know, just open my eyes to what you had to do, like, you know, what you're looking for. And, like, you don't just concentrate on your end of things, like, you know, fingerprints or whatever it is. If you see something that may be of interest to the ballistics person or the mapper or the photographer. So you work together as a team, you know. That was my first trip out, you know. And then later on, you'd go to my first murder and that type of stuff. Like, but, yeah, it's the same. Like, when you get over the first initial shock of what you see, and then you just get down to business. Because more often than not, if it does turn out to be a suspicious death, you could be there for days, you know, processing the scene and bringing stuff back to headquarters to be treated again and examined and all that sort of stuff. Like, so
how old were you when you went onto that scene?
98. Christ, I'm trying to remember now. I was about 26, I'd say, maybe.
And was that a proper shock to the system for you then?
It kind of was. The scene itself wasn't too bad because, you know, we were there searching around the place and we were looking for the fragment of the bullet. But then I remember we went to the PM afterwards, and it was a very small mortuary or morgue or whatever you may call it. But when they started the PM, you know, stripped the body and all that sort of stuff, but the air conditioning wasn't on at the start. And you know, when the PM starts and the body's opened and all that sort of stuff, you find out pretty quick if you've got a strong stomach or not. Like, because we had to step out, we had to put the air conditioning on and get, you know, get a bit of air flowing through it. But then, like, you know, I was told, like, fingerprint the body. And, you know, we usually do the printing the body when the PM is over. So the body is all dissected and opened up, and then you have to ink up the hands. And the ballistics man got me to swab the deceased's hands for firearm residue. And it was quite interesting, because he was showing me the bullets in the revolver had all these kind of just little scrapes down the sides of the casings. And he was saying, like, when his opinion was that that gun had been loaded and unloaded many times. So this poor individual had contemplated this a fair bit, yeah, you know, because yeah, he was in bed, like, you know. So, and there was no signs of disturbance. His money was in his wallet beside the bed, all that sort of stuff. So, you know, from an investigation point of view, that was it. But I often wondered years later, like, who came to clean up afterwards, you know, because, you know, I know now there's specialists that do that kind of stuff. Certainly nowadays there is, but this was in, you know, the depths of, you know, the Midlands back in the late 90s. I'd say it was up to either local neighbours or maybe even, God love them, the relatives to clean up afterwards, you know.
Mm.
You know, we leave a scene, we go on and we move on to the next one, but, that's, you know, lot, it's, yeah, still there. It's, and I found myself, there, yeah, it's only really since I got back into looking at my old notes for the podcast and stuff that I'm going down the rabbit hole trying to find out these things. I was on Google Maps there last week trying to find that house, you know, in a satellite picture or something, and I reckon I found it. Doesn't look anything like it did back then, but I reckon I found it. And I says, jeez, I'll never forget that, like, you know, because I had a photograph of myself, the photographer, because it was my first job out as a trainee. I had the white suit and that on me, so I'm standing outside the thing, the arms folded, thinking I'm great. So, and I had the photograph in front of the house, and I was comparing that with the street view. You know, it's still there. I still remember it, like, you know, not in a bad way. Like, it doesn't affect me or anything like that. But I just never forget it.
Mm.
You know, and it's funny because every time I walk up here, I come up whatever street it is. I come up off Graft Street and then cross over. There's a little post box, and it's written on that, "Don't forget to remember." And I copped that not long after I started coming in here doing the episodes. And I said, Jesus, I must, like, that's what you don't forget to remember, like, you know. And I think it's very important. And I think that's what we try to do with the cases.
Yeah.
You know, not to forget, like, you know, that these are real people that you're dealing with.
That's their story.
Yeah.
John, is it true that every single person has a unique fingerprint?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, like, I mean, you'll get people saying, and rightly so, that, you know, DNA is fantastic. And it is. DNA as a means of identification is just incredible and just keeps getting better and better and better. But identical twins will have the same DNA, whereas they won't have the same fingerprints. Mm. And there's so many factors involved in it that, and it, like, we used to have to go through a spiel for court, explain it, like, in layman's terms, to, because, you know, the skin on your hands and the skin in your feet, and that is that kind of rough thing with the patterns and all that sort of stuff. Well, all those patterns form, you know, after about 16 weeks gestation of the fetus or whatever. And there's so many factors involved with how they will form the patterns. It could be anything from the diet of the mother, or it could be anything, like, with the way the fetus is lying in the womb, all these sort of things. Because, you know, when a baby is forming, you can think, like, the hands and the feet are almost like little paws, have all these little pads on them. And the friction skin, which is the stuff the fingerprints is, you know, made out of, that forms around these pads, and then that forms the patterns. And it's just, like, it's a rant, and it's right down to a, like, each fingerprint is made up of all these friction ridges, and the friction ridges are made up of each individual, like a sweat pore and a sweat gland or whatever it is, and a piece of friction skin. And there's just so much of that to form, and it can't be replicated twice, like, you know. And you can come close, you'll find some, we've all seen fingerprints where they're quite close, but they're never right, like, because there's always something that won't agree if it's not the same person. And is it, the whole thing about it is that they're permanent from the time you're born till after you die and you decompose, unless you got a big deep cut or a burn or something like that. They'll stay the same throughout life. And so if you've got a mark from, say, that glass there, and a set of fingerprints, right thumb or something like that, all the characteristics that you can see on that developed fingerprint that you've powdered should agree with what's on the set of fingerprints, if it's the same person.
Yeah.
It's very important when you're making identifications that they're verified by other experts independently, you know. So you'd give them a mark and you'd give them a set of fingerprints, and then, you know, you don't tell them what fingerprint to look, or what finger to look at and stuff like that, so they'll verify it and stuff like that. Because when you give evidence on a fingerprint, any type of identification, person giving evidence on DNA or blood or anything like that, every time a person is given that kind of identification evidence, not only is the evidence in relation to that particular case important, you're also backing up the whole history of it before you, you know. So, like, and there's always going to be, there has been cases over the years where people have made wrong identifications, and it's usually down to peer pressure or, you know, lack of training and stuff like this, that and the other. But it brings down the whole
system,
the whole shebang when you do that, and it calls it into doubt. Just a little more.
You decided to go into then handwriting.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a big leap. You know, it was only one floor down, the same building, stuff like that. I'd done the fingerprints for 10 years. I liked it, but I was still young enough, you know, and, you know, I had two kids by that stage, and, you know, I just fancied a change, really. It wasn't that I didn't like what I was doing. I just wasn't getting the buzz out of it as I had been. And I knew there was a vacancy coming up in the handwriting end of it, and I knew that that would be what I'd get into, you know. But I had to train for it, you know. So I went for that and like that, got into it. But I started off then on document examination, like, and looking at tax discs and NCT discs and bogey money and stuff like that, passports, driving licenses, all that sort of stuff. And then we also had to do an awful lot of ESDA examination, is what it was called, when you say you write on a writing pad and indentations from that might go through onto the next several pages, so you're examining the pages for indentations. Now, they wouldn't be visible, you know, not like when you, if you were really lean, and I'm talking about, you wouldn't be able to see these, but there's a certain process with, you're using an electrical charge and you're putting a toner across and all that, that might develop the indentation. So I did a lot of that, as well as getting my eye in for the handwriting, and then I was sent on training for that. I did it 6 weeks over in Birmingham, just purely handwriting, you know. And it was a bit like fingerprints, because every time you're looking at handwriting, you're still learning. Your eye is getting in there. You're like, you know, you're starting to figure out what's unique, what characteristics of somebody's writing carry more kind of evidential weight than others and stuff like that. And I found it very interesting, because unlike fingerprints, it's not a standalone bit of evidence. Like with fingerprints and DNA, you can give that evidence as identification without having any other backup evidence, you know what I mean? Whereas handwriting is supportive evidence. It's because everybody's different, everybody writes differently, and nobody writes exactly the same way twice. So there's more kind of leeway in it. So every case stands on its own kind of strengths or weaknesses and stuff. Now, my sergeant at the time, like, he was very much into the passport and the security documents. He was shit hot with that stuff. What he didn't know wasn't worth knowing. But he didn't really go in for the handwriting thing. He used to slag us off and say, oh yeah, the definitely maybe section, you know, because very often I'd end up in court with a handwriting case and you'd only be able to give a kind of watery opinion. But it's not because handwriting as an identification form of evidence was lacking. It was just that if he didn't have enough material, if he didn't have enough writing to compare, you know. But I found the challenge great and I loved it. There was still a lot to it. Like with the security document thing, that's constantly changing, because, you know, you only look at your passport now compared with a passport from 10, 20 years ago. All the security features are different. So you have to keep on top of all those things. And people that are counterfeiting these documents are also keeping on top of what the latest security features are, and then they're trying to replicate them. So it was a constant kind of, you have to keep one step ahead. Whereas with the handwriting, it was much more of a thing that I could just get a file out, and if there was a load of handwriting in there, it'd be great. I'd just shut the mind off and just get the head down. And it was really just getting down there and sketching stuff out, you know, repeating the patterns, getting the feel for the rhythm of the writing and stuff like that, and then coming to your conclusions.
Yeah, you worked on a big case. Is it a Midland Letters?
Yeah, that one keeps following me around. And, you know, it wasn't the case that got any media attention or anything like that, because in reality, nothing really bad had happened. But it was the background of what it was then.
Yeah, people may not be familiar with it because it got no media coverage.
It got no media coverage really at the time, but we since put an episode out on it, which, you know, got a lot of attention. And what it was was a series of letters, very nasty, kind of threatening, pornographic letters, started coming in to the document section for examination from different guard stations in the Midlands. You had at Lone and Burr and Tullamore and maybe one or two others. And these letters, some of them had been sent to schools, you know, and some of them had been sent to the actual guard stations. But I got one of these letters in and did what I normally did, went down through it, sketched out all the different bits and bobs. Like, I think in the first letter there was 20 or 30 pages of it, like, you know, and this was foolscap pages, front to back, no fucking gaps, nothing. It was just full of this stuff. But the only thing is, there was no suspect, so I had nothing to compare it with. And I checked it for indentations, but I was getting nothing except what was already visible from one page to the next, you know what I mean? There was nothing there, like, that might point towards who the author was. But I just went through, did what I did, sent a report out. But then only a few weeks later, another one came in from a different station. And I remembered it the minute I saw the writing. I said, I've seen that writing before, you know. So I went back, and sure enough, it was the case that I'd done a couple of weeks previously. And then over the next several weeks or months, several more letters came in, and they were all coming in from different guard stations, you know. And I don't think at the time each investigating member was aware of the other cases. You know, if you're a guard in Athlone, you don't know what some chap in Tullamore is doing, you know. So I started to group the cases together, and I sent out a report to each of the guards saying, this ties with such and such other cases and stuff like that. I went back through the records then, and I found a letter even going back as far as 2004. I'm trying to remember now. I think it was the end of 2015 was the first one that I examined. But I got one in the records going back to 2004, which was even before I was in the section. So we were able to put all these together and say, this is the same guy, it's the same writer, like, you know. And really, really nasty stuff. Like, he was threatening to go out and kidnap teenage girls and, you know, assault them and rape them and kill them. And he was going to be the next big serial killer and all this sort of stuff. And you wouldn't believe the detail. Like, he had times and distances between towns. He'd it all planned out that he'd go out on this Saturday night and he'd look here and this is the way he'd catch a girl, and how many minutes it took then to get back to his hideout in the woods, how many minutes to kill her, how many minutes to bury her, all this sort of stuff. And as it went on, it was getting more and more, what's the word I'm looking for, he was escalating, you know. The 2004 letter that had come in had been found in a makeshift hide out in the woods, I think it was near Tullamore, where there was, you know, there was pornographic material out there, and then a kind of a cable ties and ropes and stuff like that. It was kind of like a place that he was going to bring people after kidnapping them. But it went quiet then for a little while, but the guards out in the Midlands were looking for suspects then, and they had traced some of the letters had been sent through a certain post office, say, you know, and they were looking at CCTV footage at different individuals, and there were other people that lived, you know, within the area or near where this hide had been found in 2004, and they were getting handwriting samples and sending them in to me, and I wasn't finding any matches, you know. And it was the same with the DNA. There was a girl in the DNA section, and she was finding the same DNA profile and all the letters, but there was nothing in the database, you know, to hit against it. Same with fingerprints. There was fingerprints on them, but nothing on the system.
So this is a fella that had no criminal.
Yeah, before. He hadn't come to notice before, but it kept going on a bit like that for a while. And eventually, one of the investigating members showed the CCTV footage from the post office to a retired guard. He'd been a detective in the Tullamore area for years, and he had good local knowledge, and he knew a lot of, you know, the local heads and whatnot. But he happened to twig this guy in the footage, and he said, "Did you check him out? Like, you know, he's a bit of an oddball. Might be worth checking him out." And they watched him, and they called to his house and stuff like that. His house was full of the stuff. It was everywhere, and he'd written all this more stuff, like, you know. And it was him, and he led them to another hide that he'd only completed, but this was a much more complete kind of thing. He'd a hut made out in the woods. He'd cleared out all this trees and stuff like that. He had more rape kits, all this sort of stuff. I think he'd really been buried in the ground or something as well, where he was going to keep them and all this kind of crack. And he was ready to go. He was ready to make that next step, because you could see over the years from between 2004 right up till it was 2017, I think, before he was got, that he was getting more and more vicious in the writing and stuff like that. And
had he ever been linked to anything, though, over the years? No,
they checked it and nothing, no. But, like, he was watching certain named schoolgirls and stuff like that. Like, a lot of the stuff in his letters was like that he said he'd done and who he'd killed and who he'd raped or attacked or whatever. A lot of it was fantasy, like it was made up stuff. But the later letters were identifying individuals, schoolgirls, like, and he knew their ages, he knew their addresses, all this sort of stuff. So it was getting to the point that he was going to maybe tip over into going from fantasy into reality. So he was, you know, he was arrested, and he was kept in custody up until his trial and whatnot. He's due out around now, I think, if he's not out already. I haven't heard anything. But, you know, at the time, one of the guards was saying, like, you know, this guy was a ticking time bomb, you know, and they got to him before he could go off. And that's why you wouldn't have heard anything about it, because
he didn't do anything.
It was more of a prevention thing.
Yeah.
You know.
But that's just one of them cases where it's like,
yeah,
I find it so hard to believe that someone like that can be rehabilitated. Like, when you're naming schoolgirls, it's like, how can you let someone know and just hope that?
Yeah, like, I mean, nobody does much writing anymore. You know, we're all typing or texting and whatnot. So we kind of knew back then that this guy was an older gent and maybe not tech savvy or access to computers and stuff like that. But to have that level of commitment to be, like, the amount of writing, like, and I'm just talking about the stuff that I got. Like, it was about a foot thick worth of stuff. But there was any more amount of that in his house. I wouldn't be surprised if there was numerous other letters out there that had been received at places but just not passed on to the guards or whatever, you know. But that level of commitment, I mean, he must have been at it every waking hour, you know, and he was living with his elderly parents. But I think it kind of escalated then when his mother died, and he was doing it more and more and more and more. But Yeah, like, I mean, it's just, you know, a sick individual. Like, I forget what the diagnosis was, but he was suffering sexual deviant behaviour or something like that. But I know what you're saying. Like, I mean, you'd have to think, you do your time and you come out, that's going to still be in you.
Come right, it is.
You know,
you wouldn't want to be living a few doors down from them, would you?
Yeah, like, I'm not making light of more serious crimes, say, like murder or something like that, but, you know, they can sometimes be, you know, spur of the moment,
yeah,
you know,
crimes, yeah,
of whatever, and you can come back from it maybe, you know, with the right help.
You can commit murder, like, yeah, but there was, it's never,
yeah,
you can never justify,
you
know,
you
know,
you have to be careful with how you word that.
You said something in a podcast last week. You said our last week's guest, if someone hit your ma,
yeah,
so just mean, if someone bleeding murdered someone in your family, or,
yeah,
crime of passion or something, it's called,
yeah,
passion is ever, you can have, yeah, an emotional outburst.
It's not, look, I'm not, yeah, justifying bleeding murder, but no, be situations.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean,
everyone can agree it's warranted.
Well, I don't warrant, but
be careful.
I don't know.
Well, now we are trying to say,
yeah,
just, you have to be careful with how you
judge. Well, if you read a headline,
judge, it was warranted. Oh, you're grand.
Yeah. But if someone's bleeding, Shoyle gets murdered, someone murders, everyone, yeah, says fair play.
But even, do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I'm looking into a script for an old case at the moment now. It's going back decades, like back to the 70s. Murder was committed, person convicted, given life. Life at the time in the 70s was about 7 years. Did a 7 years, but never reoffended. Still only young when he got out of prison, moved out of the country, got a job, I think got married, stuff like that, never reoffended, found fate, all that sort of stuff. So, you know,
the possibility of rehabilitation,
the possibility,
there, but can, yeah, you take that off something, yeah, that's nasty,
if it's in them, yeah, you know, I, yeah, don't know.
I think what you were trying to say, like, in certain cases where it's more out of like emotion and anger, boy, this one, it sounds like more meticulous, as he said, like, he knew the distances.
This is too deep.
Oh, yeah,
yeah, like,
yeah,
you can't rehabilitate, yeah, no, that, can you? No. Like, when you're, like,
I mean, I would, like, I mean, if I went to do, let's say, if I was traveling around to find out where I was going, delivering fucking takeaways, I wouldn't be able to get that amount, yeah, of detail with a smartphone.
Yeah.
This guy was doing it, like, without any of that stuff. He didn't, yeah, have a computer or stuff like that, you know. He was old school, because he was cutting out pictures from magazines and stuff like that and sticking them in his letter. So
he sounds like something out of Blade and Silence of the Lambs.
It's, you know what it's like? It was a bit like,
it sounds like Psycho as well.
I remember Seven. And, yeah, man, I remember the movie Seven.
Yeah.
And you managed all, yeah, you had all these ledgers with all this stuff, just, you know, full of this stuff. It's just, it was unbelievable, like, you know.
John, what was the most high profile case you've worked on?
With the handwriting, really, you know, I've been in different murder investigations and stuff like that, but I'd say probably the most high profile one was the Haw murders, the Haw family up in Cavan.
Yeah.
I don't know that one. What was that?
The husband, Alan Haw, had murdered his wife and his three sons and then took his own life. So, like, the whole family was wiped
out.
He was a teacher, two of them were teachers.
Yeah.
But, like I say, I wasn't at the scene, thanks be to God, I wasn't at the scene of that one, but he had left letters, you know, notes and letters, yeah, and stuff like that.
There was a note on the hall door saying don't go in, or don't go upstairs or something, wasn't it?
It was on the glass at the back door, please don't come in, please call the Gardaí. And this was the wife's mother who had called to the house to see where they were, like, you know, and thanks be to God she didn't go in. She called the guard. She didn't go in because,
I mean, the cop a fucking,
yeah. Well, I that's like, I did the examination on the letters. Obviously, there wasn't going to be a criminal case because they were all dead. And your man was dead and whatnot. But there was a coroner's inquest, and I had to give evidence at that to prove, yeah, he wrote them, you know. But I'll never forget being at that inquest, and like you say, like, some of the first witnesses were the two guards that were first at that scene, like, and I was just like, how in the name of Jesus?
But that just mean two local cops?
Just two local.
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah.
You know, like, I mean,
and it would have been a quiet town. Like,
quiet. Like, I mean, you're probably going in most mornings and you might be dealing with, like, maybe you might have a road traffic tip down the road or something and do a checkpoint, bit of public order, stuff like that. But then this type of stuff, like, and this would be whatever time it was, you know, 9 or 10 in the morning of a Monday morning, like, you know. But that, I would say, probably, well, it certainly sticks in my mind is, you know, one that, like, at the time, it was just, it was completely unlike anything really before that, like, a father and a husband would wipe out the entire family, you know, and to all intents and purposes, it was, everything was hunky-dory, like, whatever was simmering away in the background, like, with him, you know,
I'm not sure if it's ever even possible to find out, but was there ever like any clues of like a motive or?
There was, like, you know, like, I mean, from my end of it, I'd say, because I was only involved with the handwriting, and there was nothing really in the letters that he'd left given concrete reasons as to why he did what he did, apart from him saying that something was going to come out about him and the family would be in shape, would be so, you know, affected by this, and that it'd be better if they were all dead.
And he put that in the letters.
Yeah, and he was trying to reason that this was better for everybody this way. Now, since that, Clodagh, the mother of the three boys, her sister wrote a book, Jacqueline Connolly, and she goes a bit more into what was maybe going on a bit with him to do with something that was going to come out around his job and stuff like that. Maybe he was up to no good on the computer or something. I'm not entirely sure, you know, but you'd probably never get concrete answers because he's gone, like, you know. And there was a reinvestigation of the whole thing afterwards, but yeah, like, it's just that was, I'd say that one probably, you know, I'm trying to think, there was one or two other ones. I'm trying to think now, some of the ones that we covered. I did the Justine Valdez one then as well.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
You know what? All these cases. What?
You know all these? That's mad. What the fuck are these?
I swear to God, right? I was only thinking about this on the way in. I know all the major cases every year. I just gravitate towards them. All of them. Justine Valdez.
Yeah.
Anna Kriegel. The Graham DeWire one when he killed Elaine O'Hara. All them. I know all the details of it all.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. I just get sucked into
purely,
it.
Like, But it's normal to be lured into a story, like.
But it's mad because it's not like, you know, if you heard of like a gangland murder, I'm like, I don't want to know. Who's the victim? I'm like, right.
Yeah.
And then I move on. That's all I need to know.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't want to know the details. But see, if I heard like this fella suspecting a murder in that woman in two towns over, I want to know every detail of it. Every detail.
Yeah, like, I mean, to say the Justine Valdez one, again, I only was involved with the note that your man that had killed her, Mark Hennessy, had left behind him. And because he'd been shot by the guards and that, he'd fallen across it and it was all covered in blood, and then I had to examine it and try to decipher the writing before the fingerprinters and that washed it, just in case the ink could go. Like,
Can you give us a bit of background to that, just in case people aren't familiar with it?
Yeah, well, I think it was 2018. Justine Valdez, she was a Filipino student. She was over here living with her parents. They were living out in Enniskerry. They were working out there, and she was just coming home on the bus. I think it was a Saturday evening. She'd been out in Bray, and she stepped off the bus in Enniskerry and was walking out the road to where she was living, and this fella snatched her, like, you know, it was broad daylight on a Saturday evening. You know, there were a few witnesses that saw, you know, a girl in distress, or looked like a child, because she was only short, like, you know, in the back of this car and stuff like that. And then, you know, when she didn't come home, her parents reported her missing, and so the two things were kind of tied together, that these sightings of a girl or a young woman with long dark hair and, you know, Asian features in distress in the back of this, whatever it was, Nissan Qashqai or something. But he had snatched her, and over the next day or two, absolute huge search to find her and to identify the car and stuff like that. So they trawled through CCTV footage, like there was CCTV footage on the bus, and you could see her on the bus as she's just about to step off, and you could see the car behind, so he knew she was going to be on that bus. Now, whether he had followed her from Bray or he had seen her before, we don't know, but it seems that
there was
some sort of premeditation there, because he had gone out that evening and he just didn't come back. Like, I mean, he was living, I forget where he was living, but he was, you know, wife, kids, stuff like that, young kids. And they had identified by the following morning through the CCTV stuff and appeals to the public, they had identified the car and who the driver was, Mark Hennessy. And all through the Sunday then, I think they were searching for him in the hope of finding Justine still alive. But he was spotted in the Cherry Orchard Industrial Estate, I think it was, that evening. A member of the public saw him and called it in, and he was confronted in the car park in there, but he wouldn't get out of the car. He had it all locked and stuff like that, and he started cutting himself and stuff like that. And the guards didn't know if Justine was in the car or not, and he leaned over kind of down into the footwell on the passenger side, and they thought that she was there and he was going to kill her. So they shot through the glass, just shot once, and it hit him, and you know, hit an artery and stuff like that. So he died, I think, within a few minutes. Like, the, you know, the paramedics got him out and worked on him on the ground and stuff like that. But then the guards found that there was nobody else in the car, but they found this letter, you know, and it was covered in blood, but it did make reference to a place called Puck's Lane Golf Course, which is up, I think it's an area called Rat Michael, like it's halfway up the mountains, like, you know, just real narrow country back roads and stuff like that. So that's where the search then was concentrated overnight. And, you know, they sent the helicopters and all that up, but they were using heat-sensitive cameras, but they kept picking up deer and wild animals and stuff like that. So it wasn't until the next day, between the guards and the army and I think civil defence and all, were up doing a massive search. But they found Justine up just beside that golf course. It was a disused golf course up in a place called Puck's Lane. But they reckoned that he had killed her within an hour or so of taking her that Saturday evening. And then he'd gone out. He'd gone around a few pubs, drinking, doing coke, whatnot. And I think he had a second mobile phone that he contacted the wife on to say he wouldn't be back. So that was it. Like, and it was just like I was saying with the Haw case. And I remember it as well. Like, I mean, at the time, it was just like something you'd see on the telly in the States or something. Like, a girl just walking along the street just outside Enniskerry and just been snatched and gone, like, you know. Like, I mean, he must have had some premeditation. Like, you don't just randomly, you know, see somebody on a bus and go, there must have been some. And the chief investigator that, he's retired now, Frank Keenan, we had him on Case Notes there a few weeks ago, and he reckons that he had seen her before, or, you know, knew her routine maybe, or what bus she might be on and stuff. But again, you'll never get any answers. And they did try to search in his DNA and stuff like that against unsolved crimes, you know, of, you know, women going missing and stuff like that, because it just seemed that it was such a brazen thing to do. Had he done it before? But they never linked him to anything else. But that's not to say,
yeah,
he did it and didn't, like, you know, it might be something that didn't come to light. But yeah, that one sticks in the head too. But like, I was doing the script for that, or at least I did the first draft on it. And, you know, prior to this, I just knew a bit about the case because all I had done was the handwriting end of it. But like that, I went fucking deep dive down into it, down the rabbit hole. And it took a while to shake that one, like, you know, and Google Maps and street views of these places and stuff. But yeah, like, those two stick with me so far anyway. I don't know what else I'm going to pull out of the woodwork.
How regular was major cases like that?
Well, it depends. Like, I mean, when I started in fingerprints, there was a list up in one of the offices downstairs where exhibits were brought in. And if it was a busy year, there might be like 40 murders or 45 murders now. I think it's well over that now. Like, and then within a few years of that, we got into the whole...
Sorry, did you say there's more than 45 murders?
Well, you might be suspicious deaths, like, say.
Okay.
And like, that was a busy year. But nowadays, like, I mean, every week there'd be a call out or two, might turn out to be nothing. But then we went into the whole area of the, you know, the Limerick feuds down there, and then the feuds up here in Dublin where all the gangland stuff. So, you know, you could have nothing for weeks, and then all of a sudden, boom, 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 like there's a few of them.
John, you don't look like a copper.
Thanks be to God, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I often get told that. And
well, what does a copper look like?
You look at him and I say, what's his profession?
Tattoo artist.
Yeah.
For the record, no disrespect, yeah, John, you look like someone who does BMFib on my gaze.
Yeah. Well, I see, over the years I started, like, I mean, when I started, obviously, like, when I started in the guards, you couldn't have...
tattoos.
Well, you couldn't have them visible. If right. You had tattoos on your arms, you had to have long sleeves short. Like, you couldn't have anything other... If you wanted to grow any whiskers, it could only be a moustache. It couldn't extend further than the corners of your mouth. Your locks had to be halfway down your ear. All this stuff, you know, two fingers above the collar for the back of your neck for the hair. And this was when you were in Templemore, like, but you got inspected every week. Like, up and down the rank, they'd be inspecting you. And then, like, you know, when you're in uniform, it was the rules were still there. But then when I got into the bureau, I was straight away, you're in plain clothes. You know, which, you know, it meant most of the time short and tie and whatnot. Over the years, it kind of relaxed a little bit, and I started getting the odd tattoo, usually, you know, under my shoulder or something like that, and then maybe small ones here and there. And I just kept pushing it, you know, and And even up until late enough in the game, you still weren't allowed to have beards or anything like that. You are now. Like, obviously, you can't turn up looking like something that was dragged out of a ditch backwards, but you know, you couldn't even have a beard unless you had a medical reason for having one. And like, because I remember I was
a medical reason.
Yeah, you get a prescription to grow a beard.
You know, say if you had some horrible fucking scar beard or mark or yeah. scar or yeah. a third eye or yeah. something in your chin. But like, I remember when I started in the document section, and I only had a goatee at the time, and my inspector says to me, "Have you got permission to grow that?" Now, he was half taking the piss out of me, and I said, "Well, my missus says it's okay."
Yeah,
but he meant like, had I got permission from the chief superintendent? But that's how tight it was. You had to get permission. But by the time I retired, all of that was pretty much gone. Now, I had a beard down to there. I had to tie it up and everything. And I'd rock up in court. Okay, I'd still wear a shirt, but I wouldn't be wearing tie and suit and stuff like that. So, like, I remember being... There was two compliments I'll always remember. Well, one of them wasn't a compliment. One of them was a question. I was asked... I was down in the old Central Criminal Court, where, you know, the dome is down along the Liffey there, before the big new place was built. And I was at the back of the court, and there it was absolutely jam-packed. And a guard there came up to me and says, "Are you the Bulgarian translator?" You know, because I was there with the... I had the shaved head, I had the goatee, you know, stocky enough and whatnot. And I said, "No, actually, I'm a fingerprint expert," you know. But, and then a couple of years later, I was going to court down the country somewhere, and I had to meet a mule, as we call each other, mules, like, you know. I had to meet a mule at the back of their court. I didn't know, like, I talked to him on the phone, but I didn't know him, so I had to meet him before the case or whatever it was. And, you know, I'd be sitting there and watching for guards coming in and trying to figure out, who am I looking for? You know, because they're not going to twig me, you know. They're not going to think that this is the guy from the bureau, unless they've dealt with me before. But, like, this particular fella, and I reckoned it was him that I was looking for, sure enough it was. And he just said to me, "You're the most un-mule-like fucker I've ever met." And I was like, "Thank you very much."
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, I was delighted with that. Great, you know, that was a great compliment. And I often thought afterwards, I said, "Jesus, you know, I should have gone into something like the surveillance unit or something."
Yeah, on
you
the
know,
road.
Yeah. Or are they looking for old chaps now to do it? Like, but I suppose, you know, my name is a little bit more known now. I wouldn't get away with it. But yeah, no, I just kept pushing it. But it's a different job now. Tattoos are okay, I think. Fellas can grow the beards if they want, but I'll just keep it tidy. And, you know, the uniform is so much better than it was back in the old days and stuff like that. So it's a much more relaxed... It's not like it was.
A super dry jacket.
But, like, I mean, when I say, you know, the stuff that we had to adhere to, this was in the early 90s when I joined. But when I talk to the lads that, like, joined in the 80s and the 70s, and Jesus Christ, like,
again, yeah.
Like, you know, they're talking about buttons up, fucking starched collars and, you know, hobnail things, and getting marched up to mass on a Sunday in Templemore, like, that they march all in a couple of miles to the church, like, they were marched up to the church and marched back every Sunday. Mm. And you couldn't say, "No, I don't believe," like, you couldn't go on whether you believe or not, like, you know, all this sort of crack. But yeah, it just changes, like, it's like anything else. It's just another college now, really. Like, it's a big college.
Yeah.
I haven't been back now. It's the only thing. I'd have nightmares about it the odd time, but I haven't been back. I used to get the Templemore sweats the odd time, where I'd be dreaming I was still down there, you know. But at the same time, I had great crack down there. Like, it was most nights, especially when we started getting paid, because when we started as students down there, you got 50 quid a week. Like, and you could be driving a car up and down as well, so that wasn't much. But by the time we were finishing up, we were sworn in and we were getting wages, so, like, yeah, for pints mostly, like, yeah, you know. Yeah, yeah. So it was good crack.
Well, it helps that you don't look like a copper.
Yeah,
because we're not on edge or anything.
Ah, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, yeah,
we're usually, like, on edge around them.
Yeah, like, and I mean, that's not like, I had to go down to get my passport thing signed there a week or two ago, and your man is looking at me, and this is, I was a member myself, like, you know. All right, and then he relaxed then, like, yeah, you know. But no, I take it as a compliment. And that's nothing against guards or anything like that, but I know I don't
be against the folks.
You know, well, you know what I mean? But I mean, I don't go around talking about vehicle and, like, I mean, yeah, if I was reading that in the podcast, I'd be pretty soon somebody would say to me, "Will you stop talking like that? You don't talk like that." Yeah. You know.
Speaking of the podcast, John, how are you finding it? It's blading, took off.
Yeah, it's
don't talking bollocks numbers, the fella is.
Yeah. We don't talking bollocks numbers, yeah. Yeah, like, I mean, the numbers, the whole thing, I mean, it's all, like, I mean, when people started telling me about numbers and that, it just went above my head. I was like, is that good? Like,
you know,
like,
what do you compare it?
And, but yeah, it's flying it. And we're getting into, like, we're on season three and we're well into season three now, and I really think we've gotten into a good groove with it, because the team, you know, I'm either recording with Siobhan or the other Siobhan, Siobhan McGuire, and, you know, we
Siobhan Walsh loves a show, yeah, don't mind that.
Siobhan, it's just either of the Siobhans, yeah, you know, but I've gotten kind of more used to it. I'm not afraid to kind of maybe change one or two things in it, if not about accuracy or anything like that,
yeah,
because the scripts are very well, you know, fact checked and that beforehand. But yeah, it's flying, and it's nice to be able to, like, what I find now is certainly the last several episodes, like, what one came out this week, Elaine O'Hara came out today, and
what a coincidence.
Yeah,
well, I only mentioned that earlier.
Yeah.
Oh, did you? Yeah,
yeah.
That one came out today, and I mean, and Catherine Evan last week.
So you didn't even know that?
I didn't even know that, no.
Yeah, but like, what I'm finding with these ones, I'm as invested in it as maybe listeners are, because I'm sitting down and I'll record for a while, maybe I take a break after the first act, and I'm like, geez, this is really good, like, you know, and I'm finding out things that I didn't know about them.
Are you surprised that the Irish public have such an appetite for stuff like that?
Yeah, big time.
Yeah.
Big time.
We're like, so nosy, I think it's
because why is that a surprise? I think that all that stuff is mad interesting. Yeah.
Oh, it's mad, like, I mean, I'm the same, like, I say I don't listen to podcasts much, but more often than not, if I'm watching stuff on the telly, it's, you know, documentary, true crimes. Like, I'm watching stuff at the moment about, you know, a plane that was shot down or something like that, and the investigation into that. I think it's just people are fascinated with the whole procedure part of it. They're also, you know, kind of morbidly fascinated with terrible things that people do to each other. And I've said it before when people ask me, like, I mean, I think there's also part of it that it's somewhat comforting that if you're sitting down at home with a fucking, your dinner in front of you, or sitting there a few cans, and you're watching something terrible that's been done to somebody, and then you can turn it off and say, thank Christ that's not me,
yeah,
or anybody that I know.
Yeah.
So I think there's a bit of that in it, like, there's
but on the flip side of that, Ireland is that small,
yeah,
that it could be someone, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. I mean, we covered a case there not too long ago, and it was going back several decades, but one of the other girls here, like, it was, I think it was an aunt or an uncle, or it was a relation of hers, was one of the victims, like. Now, it wasn't that, like, we didn't know or anything like that, but it's a small world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've certainly found that in some of the feedback that I'm getting, like you were talking about that Midlands Letters case there recently, and I got contacted a while ago to do a an interview for the Garda Review. It's an internal magazine that goes out to, if you're subscribed to it. But a lovely woman did this interview with me over the phone. She was in Iceland for some reason. She was talking to me from Iceland, but she writes for she does articles for different publications. But she told me that she's Irish, like, but she said that her father had, like, not sure if he'd heard the podcast, the episode about the Midlands Letters, or he'd read, I wrote a book there after I retired about my time in the job, which I covered the Midlands Letters in. But he was an ex-guard, and he was the guard that looked at the CCTV footage, and the retired guard, remember, it said it was him. He said, that was me, I pointed out your man on the CCTV. And I was like, what? Like, it was just crazy, like, you know. She was ringing me to, you know, get an interview about the podcast for the Garda Review, and her father was actually, like, I mean, he didn't want any publicity on it. I was a quiet enough retired member or whatever, but I'm getting a lot of that now. You get a bit of feedback from other ex-guards talk to you, and maybe some serving members and that, saying, Jesus, yeah, you know, what you said on that now was, like, we did another one there. It was a murder up in Donegal, Jasmine McMonagall, and they had the crisis negotiator or something called out to that and whatnot. And he reached out and was saying, yeah, you did a good job with that. And by the way, I've a few more stories, like, you know. So it's the thing about the true crime stuff. You're never going to run out.
No.
Yeah. You're never going to. Unfortunately, you're always going to have something horrible to talk about. Yeah. You know.
People are clearly invested.
We're going to start doing deep dives into unsolved murders now.
John's down all right. Come on, lock in.
But I mean, there's so many people out there that do that. Like armchair YouTube
detectives,
whatever, detectives. Yeah. Like that program I'm watching about the flight that was brought down the Ukraine there. It's only a couple of years ago. It was just guys like that.
Same with that. Remember that one on Netflix? Don't Fuck With Cats.
Yes,
Don't Fuck With Cats. Your man Luca Mignata. They caught him.
Yeah,
just by a Facebook group. They said that's this fella, and he went and he found out it was him. Your man was blading, pulling up videos, killing cats. Yeah, but like he had his face blocked, and then put up another video a few years later, killing cats again, and people were outraged, and people were like, we're going to catch him. Setting up groups, and then your man murdered a fella, It was in Canada. I think he murdered him.
I can't remember now where it was.
Something that it was a Canadian connection in it anyways. But the Facebook group were granted the police. And like, yeah, here's all the evidence. And the Kutcher man, Luca Magnata, his name was, yeah?
And why? The same fellow that was killing cats killed someone and then they were able to link it all?
Yep.
Mad.
Yeah, but
that's
like,
that just people in like,
but there's people doing that just full time, like, you know, and...
Do you know what it makes me look like and say, hey, imagine your full time job was to go out there and catch a killer. And some fella sitting in his car part time doing it. What are you doing? John, Lines of Inquiry. It's out every Tuesday, is it?
New episode every Tuesday. And, you know, we ought to do shorter ones, incident briefs. They come out a bit less regularly. And some one-to-ones with people we've had in, case notes and stuff like that. But yeah, every Tuesday, main episode will be out. Yeah, Lane O'Hara one's out today.
Brilliant.
Congratulations on all the
success. Thanks very much. Thank you very much, lads.
Fair play to you. And your sound for a copper.
I'm ex-copper now.
He's a podcaster.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in,
John. Take us out, Siobhan.
Boom.
That's us for this week. And thanks to the legends at Roy Style Furniture for supporting the podcast.
Speaking of great support, see what I did there? Roy Style has everything. And I mean everything. Sofa sorted. Beds covered. Dining table, 6 chairs. Boom. All in one house package. Plus the lads in the store are sound. They're not pushy, just helpful. And if you're an online shopper, no problem.
Visit www.roystyle.ie and when you shop in store, tell them that the two boys from the podcast sent you and they'll throw you in a little discount.
Don't sleep on this deal, unless it's on one of their mattresses, in which case, fair play.
So get down and get the gaff sorted. Roy Price, Roy Style, right now.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app. What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in it now. Till your body is dead. Work it hard and long. When you finish that.
The Hip Knocker. Go down. Go down. Go down.